Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. This episode is part one of audio from the China at 75 celebration held on September 29, 2024 at the Malcolm X and Dr. Betty Shabazz Memorial and Educational Center in New York City. The event was organized by Friends of Socialist China and Workers' World Party. October 1, 2024 marked the 75th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China, when Mao Zedong declared that the Chinese people have stood up. 75 years ago, the People's Republic of China was a colonial holding looted by world powers. Today, China is the economic powerhouse of the world, providing hope for other developing countries of Africa and the Global South fighting for sovereignty against the forces of imperialism. U.S. threats, military encirclement, and hostile propaganda are escalating daily. In this consequential moment, it is paramount that socialist, anti-imperialist, and progressive forces join together to explain and defend the role of China today. We'll start with Charles Xu of the Chow Collective. Please note that the views expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect my own views or those of this radio station.
It's my distinct pleasure to join you all virtually to celebrate the 75th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic on October 1st, 1949. As we commemorate that event, which marked the culmination of one cycle of anti-imperialist resistance and augured the dawn of another, we also, of course, are approaching 1 year since the mass prison break known as Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. The subsequent year of Zionist genocide in Gaza, unparalleled in its depravity, is, as we well know, simply a continuation and intensification of a colonial process that predated even the Nakba of 1948. And it's notable that barely a year separated those two events in 1948 and 1949. One was the emphatic triumph of an organic people's war for self-determination in one of the world's oldest continually surviving civilizations. The other, the violent and anachronistic implantation of an alien settler colonial regime with no legitimate claims to an inch of Palestinian land. And since the United Nations General Assembly has just concluded right there in New York, affording, of course, a platform to the Hitlerite war criminal, Benjamin Netanyahu, it's worth noting that while the 1947 UN partition plan, in fact, midwifed the settler state of Israel into existence, that same UN went to war under US leadership against People's China just 2 years later and continued to exclude it for another two decades. The Nakba and the founding of the PRC may have been separated in time by only a year, but geographically they were sundered by the entirety of the world's largest continent. However, that distance was no barrier to revolutionary Pan-Asian solidarity. Indeed, as Chairman Mao told a visiting delegation of the Palestine Liberation Organization in 1965, quote, imperialism is afraid of China and of the Arabs. Israel and Formosa are bases of imperialism in Asia. You are the gate of the great continent, and we are the rear. They created Israel for you and Formosa for us. Their goal is the same. Now, the reason that delegation was received with state honors as early as 1965 was precisely because China was the first non-Arab country to recognize the PLO, and indeed was the most generous military sponsor and most strident diplomatic champion of the Palestinian cause throughout its first decade of organized armed struggle. Indeed, Yasser Arafat described China as, quote, the biggest influence in supporting our revolution and strengthening its perseverance. And George Habash, the founder of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, described China as, quote, our best friend. And indeed, through all the advances and reversals of the 1967 war, also known as the Nakba, of Black September in Jordan, the Lebanese Civil War, the First and Second Intifadas, and the capitulation at Oslo and the accompanying normalization of Zionism globally, China's contribution from that time, in fact, continues to reverberate today. Above all, we see this in the training that was received by earlier generations of Palestinian fighters in the theory and methods of asymmetric people's war against a technologically superior enemy backed by the global hegemon. These were methods that were informed and refined in the crucible of the Communist Party of China's own decades-long struggle against Kuomintang reaction, Japanese colonialism, and U.S. imperialism, culminating in the victory of 1949. These methods include, among others, the use of tunnel warfare, which propagated from China's war of resistance against Japan to Korea and Vietnam's wars of liberation from U.S. imperialism, and thenceforth, through direct training to Hezbollah and then to Hamas, as precisely the strategic depth that they need to withstand Israel's genocidal assaults on Gaza and now on Lebanon. At a broader political level, the CPC never forgot its history of United Front tactics. First, pausing hostilities to unite with the Kuomintang against Japanese colonialism, and then, after defeating Japan, allying with the KMT's own left wing and with other democratic forces against KMT rule itself. China was drawing precisely on this deep and historically informed understanding of national unity as a prerequisite to national liberation when it brokered the Beijing Unity Declaration between 14 Palestinian factions, including Fatah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and the PFLP this past July. Indeed, despite maintaining official ties with both Israel and the Palestinian Authority, the legacy of China's historical role has garnered sufficient trust from all parties involved to secure an agreement that simultaneously affirms the legitimacy of the PLO as a vehicle and the necessity for armed struggle as a method in the liberation of the Palestinian people. The Palestinians and their regional allies in the axis of resistance have, in fact, more than repaid China for these historical contributions. They've done so by broadcasting to the world their ingenious tactics of resistance to the Zionist onslaught, which have featured, among others, Chinese-made DJI drones, Hongjian 8 anti-tank missiles, Xiaomi mobile phones, and Hikvision cameras. In so doing, the Palestinians have revived anti-imperialist consciousness and popular interest among China's people in their own country's foundational history of people's war waged against similarly daunting odds. And here, I want to conclude by noting that the global solidarity movement has also done its part, even and especially right here in the heart of the Imperial Core, where the U.S. Student Intifada of April and May, which kicked off not far from here at Columbia University, drew innumerable comparisons among Chinese netizens to the May 4th movement of 1919. Now, like the recent Student Intifada, that movement too was initially quelled by the forces of reaction. But as my comrade Xiongjia of the Tricontinental Institute pointed out, it ultimately planted the seeds for the founding of a great revolutionary party just 2 years later, and its ultimate triumph in the founding of New China 3 decades on. And as we gather here to celebrate that event, let this be a reminder of how brutal and protracted the struggle will be, but also of how momentous the final victory that awaits us.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. That was Charles Hsu of the Chow Collective. Next is Danny Haifong, journalist and co-founder of Friends of Socialist China.
I will talk about China's achievements versus Western mythology. I found this to be important in the discussion of hybrid war because the information war is a huge part of ensuring that the many pillars of this hybrid war are able to continue onward unabated and unchallenged. So one of the biggest ways that we can challenge this information war, the misinformation we hear about China, is by going to China. And it is truly humbling to discuss this occasion of the 75th anniversary of the People's Republic of China when the world is facing a multitude of crises due to hybrid war, due to a global hybrid war led by the United States. Many people have brought up Palestine, have brought up what's happening to Lebanon right now, have brought up the slain leader, resistance leader, Hassan Nasrallah. There's also, of course, the meat grinder in Ukraine, this US-NATO failed campaign to strategically defeat Russia. This has all brought the world, including the hybrid war on China, to the brink of a potential nuclear conflict, and I think it's important to recognize that. In hybrid war, the victories that people have fought so hard to win is the thread that binds these crises together. So in late August, I traveled to China for the fourth time in as many years and witnessed once again what the Chinese people have accomplished in their 75 years of building socialism and building an independent Chinese nation, or what China is increasingly called a rejuvenated Chinese nation. Truthfully, in my opinion, it is really shocking, actually, that now traveling to China, one of the most open and globally integrated economically nations in the world, is becoming and has become so controversial over the past decade, especially. But when you go to China, the achievements are nothing short of astounding, and you just can't run from them. You can lie about them, but you can't run from them. So the streets are clean, the infrastructure is modern, it's very modern. So this was actually the first time I had ridden two high-speed rail trains before this, but this was the first time I rode the Fuxing, and this is the high-speed rail that connects Shanghai to Beijing. And for context, that distance is about 1,200 kilometers. This train can go 350 kilometers an hour, and you can get to one end of Beijing to Shanghai in about 4 hours. And just for some context, in the United States, if you want to travel this distance, say New York to Chicago, your fastest train here will be 19 hours. So the feat, this feat alone is, I think, incredibly just shocking for many Americans and even Westerners, where there might be high-speed rail in Spain or somewhere else, but the trains are slower. China has now become the world leader in this very key infrastructure development. When I was in China's two most developed cities, Shanghai and Beijing, I was able to interview renowned intellectuals like Zhang Weiwei, who actually participated in this event, and former People's Liberation Army Colonel Zhou Bo. And from their insights, it is clear that China has indeed stood up and is now producing intellectuals and is now producing knowledge that reflects its status as not just a rising global power, but just a global power. China is now asking, what is its responsibility to the world and what does it mean to lead? And prior to New China, so prior to the 75th anniversary, the 75th year of its founding, the impoverished and humiliating position that foreign powers subjected on China raised different kinds of questions, questions of subsistence and just basic dignity. So you can imagine that the enormity of this shift over the past 75 years just cannot be understated. What's striking when you spend time in China is this huge gap between Western media mythology and reality, which is, again, a critical component of this hybrid war. Just take the economy, for example. In the Western media, we hear story after story of China's coming economic collapse. In China, issues and real problems, economic challenges such as lower consumer spending, are viewed differently, not as a sign of collapse, but as the modest pains of a transition period. China is currently undergoing a unique transition, one that right now not many countries can say they are going through, which is from a low value added manufacturing powerhouse to a high value added tech giant on its way to modern socialism. So lower real estate prices are not viewed as some kind of crisis that the whole system is going to fall. That's just projection. That's what happens in the United States when the housing market here, controlled by Wall Street, goes into a crisis where prices fall and people are thrown out of their homes. That is viewed as an economic crisis. In China, there is a saying, there's a new slogan that was inaugurated under Xi Jinping, which is that housing is for living and not speculation. So many people, there aren't people being thrown out of their homes all over the place in China like happens here, but a lot of people will tell you that lower housing prices are actually welcomed, especially in the big cities where the cost of living got quite high over the past several decades. Reduced economic growth, 4 to 6% per year in GDP terms, is not a reason to panic in China, but the outgrowth of a particular plan. And for some context, 4 to 6% growth is still 2 to 3 times higher than Europe and the United States. But this is seen in the Western media as a huge crisis because At one point in the 90s and the early 21st century, China was growing at 10% plus. But the plan that China is undergoing right now is to inject momentum and capital into industries that will make China both the center of innovation on the planet and an economy that can open new heights for the standard of living of Chinese people. And this plan is working. Beyond slightly decreasing rates of GDP growth are explosions of growth in important fields such as renewable energy and high technology development. Huawei just released the first ever tri-fold phone with iPad-like capabilities, something that is very hard, I think, to imagine for people in the collective West who have never seen such a thing. China's undisputed leadership in the development of new energy vehicles. For example, China not only holds the majority of the world's electric vehicles in general, but about 98% of the electric buses in the entire planet. The fact that renewable energy drives about 40% of all economic growth in China, and the 13 to 14% year-on-year growth of high technology makes China's path toward a modern socialist country increasingly and abundantly clear in contrast to the collapse narratives of the United States and Western mainstream media. China right now is dealing with a historic contradiction not faced by any other country on Earth right now: the existence of relative poverty and uneven development in the face of growing abundance and a major drive toward common prosperity. That is, everyone is getting richer, incomes are growing, but it's not even just yet, and it can't be even just yet. Huge sacrifices were made and are still made in order to ensure China has this productive capacity, what Marxists like to call productive forces, necessary to achieve the goals of socialism with Chinese characteristics at an early stage. And now the emphasis is on quality development. So this is where the rubber meets the road on economic growth. It's not a reason to panic when an economy is growing 4 to 6% and quality is emphasized. So when you go to China, like I have just recently, you see this everywhere. Electric vehicles dominate eerily quiet city roads. The smoggy skies of the biggest cities are now blue. Public transit is pristine and cheap at around 50 US cents per ride. China is the land of an overwhelming number of domestically produced apps that can get you anything delivered from a meal to groceries to a mirror in under 30 minutes at an incredibly low price. At the end of my trip, I actually became sick with some mild congestion. And on numerous occasions, I had people help me buy traditional Chinese medicine online for just a few US cents to a dollar. And I would get it in a half hour or less delivered to me. So technology and tourism, you can imagine, are booming. And you can see this when you go to the Bund, which I did in Shanghai on a Monday evening. And it was absolutely packed, thousands of people. Some people tell me that it gets up to a million people on the Bund on some of the busiest days, and hundreds of thousands easily every single day. Or the lines out the door when new releases of Chinese-made products, such as the Huawei Mate XT, that tri-fold phone I was talking about, hits the shelves. I got to spend a week in Xinjiang this time around. I've been there once before, but this was my second visit, and it was my most memorable because I visited, and this is a big part of the hybrid war and information war on China. I visited an exhibition on the terrorism that happened there in Xinjiang. It witnessed huge displays meant to educate new officials, new police officers, and other people of the horrors that transpired over the course of the period of 1990 and 2016, when thousands of attacks brought instability and killed or injured thousands. I spoke with academics, business owners, ordinary people, and a threat emerged. Xinjiang is not the nightmare we are told in the Western media. It's more peaceful than it has ever been. It is more prosperous than it has ever been. It is more ethnically unified than it has ever been. This last statement garners the most controversy in the collective West. I spoke with an imam at a mosque. I saw dancing and celebrations in the streets every single day, wherever you went. And I crossed the Belt and Road into Kazakhstan and back in a matter, it was easy, in a matter of minutes. There's an open border. There's booming trade between Kazakhstan and the five Central Asian countries, Russia included, and China. The wealth of ethnic diversity in Xinjiang, when you go to places like the Kazakh Autonomous Prefecture and all along its borders, is bringing with it an immense advantage under China's socialist economy, as tradition and culture is not only preserved but elevated to benefit both the increases of income of local people and to integrate the economy of the entire country and Xinjiang in particular with their neighbors to the west onward toward the rest of Europe. This is a huge hallmark of the poverty alleviation campaign, but truthfully, the Belt and Road Initiative that directly questions the legitimacy of what we see in the information war on China, the but at what cost narrative. How much is this costing? What is the cost of integrating China with the rest of the world? What is the cost of alleviating poverty? What is the cost, we hear over and over again, of China's particular policies with regard to Xinjiang? Well, actually, the cost is really a benefit. A critical element of the hybrid war on China is ideological. Information war goes hand in hand with the U.S. Empire's stated policy on containment. Containment is really just a nice word that sums up the U.S. elite's anxiety about China as not only the biggest perceived threat to U.S. hegemony, but one that is incapable of defeating China in a conventional war. We are being told by every segment of the ruling elite to hate China, to misunderstand China, and to fear China. The more we hate, the more we misunderstand, and the more we fear China, the easier it is for the rest of the hybrid war's economic and military policies to continue unchallenged. But I have the utmost confidence from both my travels and study that China will continue to reach new heights on the path to modern socialism. The Chinese people will defend their sovereignty with every inch of their lives. China's role as leader of the multipolar world will grow by leaps and bounds. It is we, the people here residing in the United States, those of us in this room, those of us watching, those of us who are unable to be in this room, who are not watching, who have the most work to do to win the kind of society that is driven by people's interests rather than naked profit, and peace rather than endless war. This is the biggest contribution we could make to the global class struggle, and indeed, this is China's biggest lesson to us all, because that is what they have won for themselves, and the benefits of their victory are being felt far and wide, inside and outside of China.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. That was Danny Haifeng, journalist and co-founder of Friends of Socialist China. Next is Joo-hyun Park of Nodutal for Korean Community Development.
While today is a very happy occasion, we are also meeting in perilous times. The crisis of the imperialist system has led to the outbreak of punishing wars in Eastern Europe and Western Asia. And as we speak, war clouds are gathering in East Asia under the auspices of the new Cold War. And it is our belief that the Korean Peninsula has now emerged as the most volatile flashpoint in the region. Korea today is at the highest risk of war that it has been in for decades. While it is true that since 1953, the Korean War has been in a suspended state, and while it is true that for all this time, the United States has retained tens of thousands of troops, dozens of military bases on our peninsula, there has been a significant change over the last couple of years. What I'm speaking of is changes in the political conditions within the peninsula itself, which have now deteriorated to the point that we can say we are in a new era of Korean history and therefore the history of the region as well. What is the cause of this change? To begin, the South Korean regime today has deteriorated to a more reactionary and subservient position than it has been for decades. Under the current president, Yoon Suk-yeol, the Republic of Korea has declared its right to launch preemptive strikes against the DPRK. It has also declared Pyongyang its so-called principal enemy. Last year, the Republic of Korea betrayed the masses of Korean people on both sides of the peninsula and around the world by entering into a military alliance with Japan, our first colonizer. It has also rolled out the red carpet for a massive escalation in U.S. war threats in Korea. In 2023, U.S. Forces Korea engaged in 200 days of war exercises on our peninsula. This spring, the militaries of 12 nations were invited to participate in these barbaric war games for the first time ever. And just last month, the United States and the Republic of Korea held a series of nuclear war exercises on our peninsula, initiating rehearsals for a nuclear strike on Korea, which are likely to only grow in their complexity and severity in the years to come. So given these and other escalations, the DPRK made the momentous decision earlier this year to abandon the strategy of peaceful reunification with the Republic of Korea. The DPRK now recognizes a paradigm of two hostile states on the Korean Peninsula for the first time in its history. This marks a definitive end to the era when peaceful reunification remained a possibility in Korea. The only party at the present moment that is speaking of reunification in explicit terms is the Republic of Korea, under the auspice of what it calls a new freedom-based unification doctrine. This calls for regime change in the DPRK via means of color revolution or by any means necessary. It is simply a recipe for war. So we are now in a sharper and more dangerous stage of the Korean anti-imperialist struggle. Consequently, the peninsula has now become the most volatile flashpoint in East Asia, where the contradiction between the forces of imperialism and anti-imperialism are at their highest, and therefore so is the threat of war. We must note that there has not been a single conflict on the Korean Peninsula since 1895 that did not involve outside powers or eventually spiral into a regional confrontation. If the US imperialists and South Korean ruling class succeed in achieving a war in Korea, this will spiral into a regional war and likely into a global one as well between nuclear powers. These conditions raise a point of strategic concern for the world anti-imperialist movement, and particularly for those of us here in the United States. As friends of revolution everywhere, as anti-imperialists, as socialists, we have to collectively recognize the need to confront the US's military encirclement of China. We also have to recognize the particular role of solidarity with the national liberation struggles of occupied countries in the vicinity. And we have to see that there is a special role that the DPRK plays in US imperialist strategy. The United States cannot always afford politically to antagonize China, because China has become a world power. However, Washington can always lean on the DPRK as a reliable scapegoat and thereby achieve the same strategic aims in the region. We have to note that the new Japan-Korea-United States alliance and the Japan-Philippines alliance were both formed citing the alleged threat posed by the DPRK as their justification. As a result, what we're now seeing is that Asian NATO is rising, using the DPRK as a very reliable scapegoat, and we know that that structure will be weaponized against all the countries of our region. So it's in recognition of these facts that Noruto has launched the US out of Korea campaign earlier this year. I'm very proud and happy and grateful to note that a number of the organizations in attendance today have endorsed this campaign, joining more than 60 organizations around the US that have thrown their weight behind the call for the United States to leave Korea for good. The reason we've called this campaign is to redirect the energy of the former peaceful reunification movement towards a direct confrontation with US imperialism. Since the end of Japanese colonialism, the process of decolonization and national liberation in Korea have been violently interrupted by the United States. For the past 79 years, the United States has waged a war against the Korean people, which is in actuality a war against all the peoples of Asia, all the working peoples of the world. And it's in that spirit that we recognize that this campaign is not only for Korean people, but for all progressive peoples of the United States and the world who oppose imperialism and struggle for a common future. Consequently, we've put forward the following demands, and I urge everyone here and all of you listening on Zoom to visit usoutofkorea.org to learn more. Our first demand is the full and permanent withdrawal of US troops and weapon systems from Korea and the immediate return of all Korean land, water, and airspace appropriated by the US military to the Korean people. Secondly, we demand an end to all U.S.-South Korean alliances, including the Japan-Korea-U.S. Trilateral Security Cooperation. We demand an end to all U.S.-South Korea joint command structures, the Combined Forces Command, the United Nations Command, any form in which they may take, recognizing that these primarily exist for the U.S. to dominate South Korea militarily and use it as an appendage. Third, we demand an end to all U.S. military exercises in Korea, all forms of war threats against the DPRK, including sanctions against the North Korea, whether they be implemented through the United States government or the UN Security Council. And fourth, we demand the U.S. government divert spending from war, prisons, and policing. We demand housing, education, healthcare, and climate justice for working people. There are $1.5 trillion that the U.S. expends on war alone every single year. Meanwhile, we have hurricanes buffeting Appalachia. We have homeless people in the streets of this city. We have more child poverty than we have seen in decades. We say enough is enough. Thus far, since the launch of our campaign, we have staged rallies this August, attended by hundreds of people in three cities, against the annual Ulji Freedom Shield U.S. War Games in Korea, which are some of the largest military exercises on Earth. We will continue to mount and expand our resistance in the coming years. We invite everyone here to participate in that process and join us in the work of providing further education, not only to the general public, but also to the left concerning the U.S.'s role in Korea and the war threats that are emanating from it. We know that we're at a pivotal time in U.S. politics. Many people are wondering how the outcome of this election will shape the future of this country and the world. We can't see the future, but one thing that we know for certain is that in the years to come, as the U.S. enters its final crisis, it will only sink its teeth further into Korea as a means of achieving war in the region. So we stand ready to interrupt that process, to organize people, to mount resistance and fight for a liberated future where we no longer have to contend with the threat of imperialism domestically or abroad.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. This episode is part one of audio from the China at 75 celebration held on September 29th, 2024 at the Malcolm X and Dr. Betty Shabazz Memorial and Educational Center in New York City. That was Joo-hyun Park of Nodutal for Korean Community Development. Next is Dee Knight of DSA International Committee's China-Asia Subcommittee.
I'd like to start by thanking the Chinese leadership for its unconditional solidarity with Palestinian liberation and continuous efforts to stop Israeli slaughter and apartheid. I want to dedicate this talk to my friends Terry Klug and John Catalinato, who devoted much of their youth to organizing active duty U.S. soldiers and sailors through the American Servicemen's Union. John later wrote Turning the Guns Around, a political memoir of this experience. I recommend it. And Terry devoted much of the rest of his life to regular labor union work. I knew them for their work in the resistance, which I shared. It's also good to take this opportunity to highlight the inestimably powerful contribution Malcolm X made to forging anti-imperialist consciousness among the entire U.S. population, but especially among African American youth, which inspired the Black Panther Party, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, and many other formations, which were key factors in the development of a movement that helped stop the U.S. war against Vietnam. I was born in 1946, last century, just days after the U.S. dropped the first nuclear bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and 3 years before Chairman Mao declared in Tiananmen Square that China has stood up. Very soon, a hysteria raged in Washington, D.C., over who lost China. Almost immediately, General Douglas MacArthur launched plans to invade or bomb the new Revolutionary Republic before it could start its socialist transformation. But during the so-called Korean War, which was also specifically aimed at China, U.S. war efforts were stymied by 500,000 Chinese volunteers. General MacArthur called for nuking China, but failed to get a green light for his vicious plan. Nevertheless, U.S. hostility continued and nearly boiled over several times in the 1950s. And when the U.S. anti-communist crusade shifted elsewhere in Asia, to both Vietnam and Indonesia, China was also always in its crosshairs, and China responded with anti-imperialist solidarity. China consistently and constantly wages peace through its Belt and Road Initiative and many other amazing efforts to share with its neighbors across the global South. So it has many more friends than enemies, while the U.S. constantly wages war to sustain its domination of the world. Today, as the U.S. conducts endless aggressive war plans against China, arming Taiwan and deploying special forces troops there in violation of its promise to respect the One China principle, deploying a vast armada of warships in the East and South China Seas, extending NATO to East Asia, forcing Japan to rearm while deploying nuclear submarines and missiles in South Korea, Okinawa, and the Philippines, the danger of hot war against China is greater than ever. The people of these countries have been mobilizing and protesting constantly against U.S. efforts to use them as proxies in wars against China. It's very much like the cynical way that Biden, Blinken, and Victoria Nuland contrived to overthrow a Ukrainian government that had a peaceful relationship with Russia, replacing it with a fascist cabal that is now used as a battering ram in a proxy war against Russia. The devastating cost in Ukrainian and Russian lives has been overwhelming, as has the damage to other countries the U.S. has bludgeoned into helping in this criminal enterprise, which has brought the world to the brink of World War III. The same or worse devastation looms now as U.S. aggression proceeds, with huge joint U.S.-South Korean war games using nuclear-armed fighter bombers, missiles, and nuclear submarines, and constant warship sparring in the South China Sea, in which the U.S. Navy uses Filipinos as proxies while reestablishing massively armed U.S. bases in the Philippines, just south of Taiwan and Hong Kong. The people of Japan, especially those in Okinawa, are subjected to nonstop danger and devastation resulting from U.S. military occupation. People in these countries have mobilized continuously against being used as proxies in aggressive U.S. war preparations against China. They are natural allies of the American peace movement as we plan to oppose and stop the U.S. war machine. They have a real need to appeal to the tens of thousands of U.S. soldiers and sailors who are stationed at military bases near their homes. In the Philippines, the popular mass movement was successful in the early 1990s in forcing the U.S. to withdraw from its bases on their soil. We know they want to force the U.S. out again, just as the people of Okinawa and South Korea want to end the hell of U.S. military occupation, which constantly endangers the local population with outrages that are never controlled or punished. We also know that many of the U.S. soldiers and sailors themselves are aware of the danger they face as cannon fodder or sitting ducks for U.S. war plans. We need to find ways to help these young people resist and say no to their unjust fate, just as happened back in the days of the U.S. war against Vietnam. These young people can take inspiration from the incredible courage of Aaron Bushnell, who sacrificed his own life rather than allow himself to be used for U.S.-backed genocide against the Palestinians. It's worth noting that Bushnell specifically was refusing to be part of U.S. military Air Force orders to help Israel target their murder victims from satellites and from the air, just as has happened recently in Lebanon. We also need to be aware of the growing number of U.S. government employees who have resigned rather than participate in this monstrous genocidal lie. We need to encourage more of that. Desertion, resistance, resignation, refusal. The people can decide. And we can do it. We can stop the U.S. war machine and bring peace. Thank you.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. That was Dee Knight of DSA International Committee's China-Asia Subcommittee. Next is Ken Hammond of the Party for Socialism and Liberation.
When we think about socialism with Chinese characteristics, what we're really considering is a practical application of the ideals, the principles, the analytical methodologies of dialectical materialism. Looking at the actually existing conditions in China and adapting the theoretical prospects or the theoretical propositions of Marxism, Leninism to the realities that are on the ground in China. This is a process, a project that began with the establishment of the Communist Party back in 1921 and was a long and arduous struggle. The 1920s was a very difficult period. But finally, by the 1930s, under the leadership of Mao Zedong, the Chinese Communist Party placed itself on a successful path of revolution by understanding the idea that the peasantry were, in a sense, rural proletarians, as Mao described them, and were the natural allies of the industrial working class. That methodology, that principle, that tactical approach led to the success of the revolution in 1949, and China embarked upon its course of development since then. And these past 75 years have seen this idea of applying dialectical materialism, applying Marxism-Leninism to the real conditions of China, take us down a long and complicated path with lots of ups and downs, lots of victories, lots of failures, lots of successes, lots of defeats. It's been a tumultuous history in many ways, but one which has unfolded along a course aimed at improving the lives of the Chinese people, building a socialist future for China, and creating a system that was based on the public ownership of wealth and its application through the instrumentalities of the Chinese state to improving the livelihoods of the people and raising the standards of living and all that. From 1949 to 1976, this was a very difficult process, a process where tremendous growth was made and housing conditions, healthcare, educational opportunities, all kinds of things were improved and enhanced. But there was a lot of conflict within the party, within society, over what the best path forward was. And this was a period, of course, where culminating with the Great Proletarian Cultural Revolution, where different groupings within the party, different interpretations of how best to build socialism came into conflict with one another. That period comes to an end after the death of Mao Zedong in 1976. And since 1978-79, China has been embarked upon a path of reform and opening to the outside. That path has itself had different phases, different periods of time. There was a long period of what we might call accommodation with the West. The idea of reform and opening was that China wanted to develop its economy rapidly to expand and enhance its productive capabilities. And in order to do that, they needed access to capital, to technology, to other kinds of knowledge and experience from the outside, from the capitalist world. And this necessitated for a period of time, the 80s, the 90s, even into the beginning of the present century, where China accommodated itself to the global capitalist system. It went along to get the things that it needed for its own development. But about 13 years ago, China entered into what is called the New Era, at this point still under the leadership of Xi Jinping. And this is a period where we have seen China, in a sense, the Chinese people once again standing up. Mao Zedong very famously in 1949 on October 1st said the Chinese people have stood up. And as they have made their way forward and as they have struggled to build a better future for themselves and indeed to become something of a model for other developing peoples in the world, once again, now, the Chinese people have stood up, and they are no longer making this sort of accommodation with the West, particularly with the United States. that has led to a period of conflict, a period where the United States has become increasingly hostile and aggressive. The pivot to Asia has, you know, is aimed at encircling China, containing China. And that's something that all of us who support the Chinese revolution and support the struggle for socialist construction everywhere that it's possible, this is something that we have to fight against. The struggles against American imperialism, of course, aren't only concerned with China. Right now, of course, we know that American imperialism is aggressively asserting itself in the world in places like Ukraine and the Israeli genocide in Gaza. And we have to oppose all of those things as well. The key to the success of socialism with Chinese characteristics is the maintenance of the socialist core in China. The new era where China is today, this era of reform and opening and the ending of the accommodation with capitalism, with Western capitalism, this is unprecedented territory. China is charting a new path every single day. And it's one in which that struggle, that effort to build a socialist future, we need to support it, we need to encourage it, and we need to congratulate the Chinese people on the wonderful things they have accomplished over the last 75 years. So as I say, it's a wonderful thing to be here today and share this moment with you. And I express my solidarity with the people of China and with all of you comrades who are here celebrating it together.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. That was Ken Hammond of the Party for Socialism and Liberation. Next is Margaret Kimberly, executive editor of Black Agenda Report.
Good afternoon. Good to see you again. And power to the people. Power to the people. Excellent. Very well said. My mentor, Glenn Ford, may he rest in peace, he always started. And so I don't speak without saying the same thing. But thank you all again for being here. We're just 2 days away from the 75th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. And I would be remiss if I did not speak of what's happening in Lebanon with the continuation of Israeli and U.S. war crimes, the assassination of Hassan Nasrallah, the deaths of, as I said, nearly 200,000 people. But this is connected. We understand that this effort, imperialist effort, to wage war on the entire region of Western Asia makes this commemoration all the more important. We're not just commemorating a successful revolution, but also the beginnings of changes in power relationships around the world, which coincided with the post-war stirrings for independence across the global South. And I'm going to talk about Africa and its relationships with the People's Republic of China, which began first as China was an example of the possibility of freedom from the capitalist imperialist world. I'm very fortunate this year. I had an amazing opportunity to visit China as part of a Friends of Socialist China delegation, as guests of the China NGO Network for International Exchanges, visiting Beijing, Zhejiang, and Jilin. And I saw for myself why China has leapfrogged over the rest of the world in its economic development. The dedication to the principles of socialism and a commitment to worldwide cooperation has made relations with China attractive to the entire continent of Africa. Recently, 53 nations, there are 54 nations in Africa, so that means every nation but one, attended the recent Forum for China-African Cooperation, known as the Forum, in Beijing. And why would they? Well, I guess a better question is, why wouldn't they? Considering the ways in which African nations are treated by the capitalist West. And here's an example. We all know that the U.S. imposed sanctions on Russia 2 years ago, but they gave no thought to the relationships, the needs that the commerce between African nations and Russia for grain, for fertilizer. And they just said, well, we're going to sanction you if you keep buying it. But there were agreements worked out, but the UN representative, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, she was shaking her finger at the Africans, and if you deviate from this, we're gonna sanction you all. So why wouldn't African nations want to get away from those toxic relationships. China's devoted to cooperation, providing debt forgiveness that Western nations, has the World Bank and the IMF, do they ever forgive debts? I don't think so. And during the forum, President Xi Jinping promised better trade relations and market access for the so-called least developed countries, including 33 on the African continent. Quote, China will voluntarily and unilaterally open its markets wider, giving LDCs that have diplomatic relations zero tariff treatment for 100% tariff lines, unquote. And so we have the possibility of something new. And we hear about the debt trap and China's, you know, they just take stuff from Africa. And there is that. I'll get to some of that. But there is nothing like this, this willingness to change the structures of economic relationships around the world. Now, there are contradictions, of course, because these 50 African nations are all very different. So, for example, all these heads of state showed up. So you would have Rwanda and Uganda there, but they've spent decades violently pillaging the Democratic Republic of Congo. But all three were there. There's a newly formed alliance of Sahel states, Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso. They've been under attack. Thank you. By some of their neighbors in the ECOWAS, which is supposed to be an economic grouping, but it's under the thumb of the U.S., who even threatened military intervention against those same countries. So we have the Western stooge nations and those who are seeking independence that were all present. And I want to point out, if I talk about African nations, I think we should always mention Eritrea, the one country that has maintained its commitment to socialism, which is why it's always under attack. That's why it's, you know, it's considered a slur. It's called the North Korea of Africa, you know, as if North Korea, the DPRK, is some kind of weird slur. Eritrea is just a country that has maintained its independence, that doesn't want to take loans from the World Bank, and it suffers because of sanctions. But it's important, very important, that China maintain its commitment to having more equitable relationships and not be like you, the U.S. and Canada and Europe, and merely extract. Chinese construction companies in DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo, for example, have agreed to invest up to $7 billion in infrastructure projects as part of their agreements in mining there in the DRC, which is very important. You know, what happens in the DRC is it's a human rights catastrophe. We've all seen the images of men, women, and little children just with a bucket and a shovel mining minerals and resources that other people use to get rich. So I think it's very important that we keep an eye on this, and the Chinese corporations live up to these commitments to change these relationships so there's not merely extraction from that country. So the theme of the forum was, flowery title, joining hands to advance modernization and build a high-level China-Africa community with a shared future. Great title. But it encapsulates how China is approaching nations of the global south. And that explains why African nations want to join the BRICS. Originally, Brazil, Russia, BRI. Thank you. China and South Africa, now Iran, Ethiopia, UAE, and Egypt. And the BRICS have yet to create their own currency. But just this effort, to beginnings of an effort to escape dollar domination and to fight against the terrorism of the U.S. sanctions regime is enough to create endless screeds against China and against these countries which are just seeking to live free from domination. And I realize I should mention coming up is the anniversary of the founding of AFRICOM, the U.S. Africa Command. Founded in 2008, the last few months of the George W. Bush administration, really ramped up under Obama. Now almost every African country, except for two or three, have a military relationship with the U.S., Why? They were trying to stop China's relationship, economic relationship with the African continent. And as you probably know, the U.S. has divided the whole world into command structures, NORTHCOM, SOUTHCOM, INDOPACCOM, and AFRICOM. And as part of the Black Alliance for Peace, we are having our annual month of action against AFRICOM. And so I wanted to mention that too, because that is also connected with China's relationships. And there was something else that occurred to me that doesn't appear to be connected, but I think it is. Secretary of State Blinken, a couple of weeks ago, attacked RT, the Russian-based network, and said it was a tool of Russian propaganda and it should be sanctioned even more. That was not surprising. But he also singled out an African network called African Stream. It's a platform, it's a very good platform, and he said they were Russian propagandists without any evidence. And it was very odd. It was like, well, why would he turn on African Stream, which has now been deplatformed by Meta, all the Facebook platforms, deplatformed by YouTube, taken off of Stripe, so far still on X, Twitter, but who knows for how long. And I think it's connected with China's outreach to African nations, Russia's outreach to African nations, that this online platform, which dares to present a different narrative, is turned into an enemy, and they seek to destroy it. Because if people have even most basic information, then you will question U.S. actions in Africa, all over the world. So I thought that was important to bring up in talking about China's relationships with African nations. The U.S. and Europe want to cut off those relationships, as it does for the rest of the world. They don't want African nations to have a different relationship. And as African people throughout the diaspora, they don't want us to have different relationships. And I think it's important to mention not just the nations of the African continent, but the relations of the African diaspora. Dr. Horn referred to Shirley Graham Du Bois, and there has been constant, on the part of revolutionaries, this urge to connect with China, to see China as this example, which is why, in general, anti-Chinese propaganda is so dangerous. It's an effort to indoctrinate. It's an effort to stop revolutionary activity. And so W.E.B. Du Bois visiting China, and Paul Robeson visiting China, and Huey Newton visiting China, it's all connected, and it tells you how important it is that African people maintain these relationships, see China for ourselves, and judge for ourselves. And the fact that that is something that is condemned so strongly tells us quite a lot. So I brought in a lot, but I will wrap it up here. Long live the People's Republic of China. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Essential Dissent, and you just heard Margaret Kimberly, executive editor of Black Agenda Report. This episode was part one of audio from the China at 75 celebration held on September 29, 2024, at the Malcolm X and Dr. Betty Shabazz Memorial and Educational Center in New York City. The event was organized by Friends of Socialist China and Workers World Party. Thanks for listening, and remember, never believe anything until you hear the official denial.